Today we're going to do a public hearing on ballot measure 3, an act to increase the Alaska minimum wage. I'm Mead Treadwell, and this is the third of 8 hearings the Lieutenant Governor's Office will host on this measure, which is on the November ballot. Our agenda today is simply to run this meeting as close to a legislative hearing as possible. As you know, what happens in a legislative hearing is sometimes you learn how a bill works. You learn the mechanics of what makes the bill go. The second thing is you'll hear from pro side and con side. And the pro side and the con side will bring arguments to the table. And if you bring arguments to the table and you would like to supply us with documentation for, say, a study on the effect of minimum wage on job growth or something like that, we're very happy to include that on the website where we have the hearing record. And so I make that recommendation. I make that offer to people here today. What we'll do is start with an agenda where we present a cost an analysis of the proposed bill and a cost estimate of the bill, and then we ask the pro side and the con side each to give us about 10 minutes, and then we'll go to public testimony. And to the extent that we have experts from the Department of Labor, do we have any experts or anyone here from the Department of Labor online? No one online here on this one. We've had them in the past, and if there are questions that people would like to ask, we can try to get this answered. Let me just first start with a summary of the bill. And the summary of the proposed bill, this bill would increase Alaska's minimum wage from $7.75 an hour to $8.75 an hour effective January 1st, 2015, and to $9.75 an hour effective January 1st, 2016, and thereafter adjusted annually for inflation. It would create a method for annual inflation adjustment for minimum wage, but if that method does not yield a state minimum wage that is at least $1 higher than the federal minimum wage, it would require the minimum wage to be at least $1 over the federal minimum. And then finally, tips or gratuities would not count for the minimum wage, so-called tip credit for the subject of separate legislation from time to time. I'm going to turn now to the bill itself, and a copy of the bill language is here. It's just 2 pages. The initiative petition language would repeal and reenact Alaska Statute 23.10.065A and would require that the minimum wage in Alaska be raised by $2 in 2 installments over the next 2 years, from $7.75 to $9.75 by January 1st, 2016. It provides a method for calculating the annual adjustment for inflation after 2016, and it states that if the minimum wage determined by the proposed annual adjustment is less than $1 over the federal minimum wage, the Alaska minimum wage shall be set at $1 over the federal minimum wage. This citizen initiative, if a majority of votes favor opinion, goes into effect 90 days after I certify the results of the election. So the election will be held the first week of November. We have absentee ballots, question ballots that come in. Sometimes if a measure is close, it may take us a little bit longer to certify, but we will usually certify by mid-November. And this bill would become effective 90 days, but that would put it mid-February. As you know, part of the bill has a minimum wage rate that goes up in January. That bill would not actually, the minimum wage rate, you know, stating the bill in January, would not go up until mid-February. This bill is not subject to veto, unlike other bills that pass the legislature, and it may not be repealed by the legislature within 2 years of its effective date. And that's according to the Alaska Constitution, Article 11. And although the legislature may amend an initiative during the first 2 years, may not operate to effectively repeal the initiative by amendment or vitiate the intent. And there's a number of different legal cases that have tested that theory one way or another from the Constitution. We worked, as we do with all initiatives, to go across the board, working with the Office of Management and Budget, to publish a cost estimate to the state of Alaska for the implementation of the minimum wage increase ballot initiative. And right now, the major cost to the department, to the state,
is actually the process of doing the initiative. It's about $80,000 for the initiative share, so to speak, of the ballot information pamphlet that we send out to Alaskans of doing these hearings and so forth. The Department of Labor has estimated that the cost to the state directly is $2,083, and that's mostly for producing 5,000 posters of the summary of the Wage and Hour Act, 5,000 Know Your Rights child labor brochures, and 1,500 Alaska fishing industry brochures going to 2,083. It doesn't include postage for sending those out, I presume, because the Department of Labor sends out those posters anyway, no matter what they say. And I will say that we asked at the time the ballot cost estimate was being done whether or not there were any state employees whose wages would go up as a result of this, and I was told that there are no direct state employees who are paid minimum wage. Everyone is paid higher than minimum wage in the state system. So just going back to our agenda now, I'm going to invite Commissioner Ed Flanagan, former Commissioner of the Department of Labor and one of the sponsors, to come to the front and to give 10 minutes of testimony in favor of his measure or any amount. So April's going to call up the PowerPoint.
I'm Ed Flanagan, and the chair of the Alaskans for a Fair Minimum Wage. We are an ad hoc group formed specifically for the purpose of getting this initiative on the ballot before the voters and getting it passed. My co-chairs are two other former state labor commissioners, Jim Sampson of Fairbanks and Tom Cashman of Jim. And will I hit the meeting? Great, thank you.
Okay.
Or page down.
The governor ably described what the initiative does, so I don't have to spend a lot of my 10 minutes doing that. But what it does, it goes to 975. It's a modest proposal. We've had a lot of people when we collected signatures telling us that we should have probably gone higher than that, but we think this is a reasonable proposal that really carries forward what would have happened had the legislature not in 2003 repealed a cost of living index that they had just enacted the year before in a 2002 bill to raise the minimum wage. And Alaska is the first state in the country, was the first state in the country to establish a higher than federal minimum wage for the state. And it was our first legislature in 1959 that did that. The federal minimum wage at the time was $1. The first legislature said, well, in Alaska it's going to be $1.50. And the next year or the year after, they said it'll always be 50 cents over the federal. At first, it was just the flat $1.50 without reference to the federal minimum wage. And that kept us the highest in the country, as was certainly appropriate with our highest cost of living for those decades, for over 30 years. And then in the top four or five for several years into the 90s when other states started to put past their own initiatives. And in 2001, Governor Knowles introduced a bill to raise it from 565, get away from the 50 cents over federal, to 715 an hour, effective. Actually, it was going to be in two jumps, just like our bill, on January 1st of 2002 and 2003. But that bill was stalled in the first session of that legislature, and the AFL-CIO got an initiative approved to get on the ballot, got 50,000 signatures, and all of a sudden the legislature got interested in moving the bill and did pass it, but with the result that the raise took effect all in one jump on January 1st, 2003. Mm-hmm. Minimum wage went up 27% overnight because there wasn't the two-step process like we have here. Basically, we've gone from being number one in the state, in the country, for so many years and among the highest, and that bill in 2002 put us back at number one. But with the legislature repealing the cost of living, we were frozen at 715, and actually in 2009 the federal minimum wage was going to 7.25, would have even surpassed the Alaska rate. So the legislature added a dime immediately and then put back in, effective January 1, 2010, the 50
cents over federal provision. So as a result, we're at $7.75 an hour since January of 2010. We're in 19th place now, 20th if you count the District of Columbia. We're behind even such low cost of living, low wage states as Florida and Arizona. If the initiative were to not pass, we drop to 21st place on January 1st, even behind West Virginia then. This shows, and we're not the most expensive state to live in anymore like we were after statehood and for a long time. We're fourth now. But as was brought up in the Barrow hearing the other day, there's a big difference between basically Anchorage and the whole rest of the state as to what your cost of living is compared to any other state, even Hawaii. Now, lots of times critics, in fact, for decades, every time the minimum wage was due to be increased, and it used to be raised on the federal level, pretty much a nonpartisan process, bipartisan, about twice a decade on average, there would be agreement, consensus in Congress, and the minimum wage would be adjusted over the next couple of years. But it was always arguments from conservative economists and others, employers, some employers of low-wage workers, that you were going to kill jobs because if you raise classic economics, microeconomics, theoretical economics, if you raise the price of something, including labor, people are going to buy less of it. Well, finally, around the early 90s, a couple of economists said, hey, you know, we've been doing this every 5 years only, except not during the 80s. There was virtually no increase from 81. There was no increase from 81 to 91 or to 90. Has any of that stuff ever happened? And they looked at a 1990 or 89 wage increase where I believe New Jersey went up. Pennsylvania stayed the same. There was two adjacent counties in the same urban area, bi-state urban area, and they did an intensive study of fast food restaurants and employment in fast food and found that actually employment in the area that increased the minimum wage in that county, fast food employment increased. And because, guess what, low-wage workers had a little more money and could maybe once in a while go out to eat in a fast food joint. Now, we have a really good empirical example here in Alaska because in 2002 to 2003, in that experience, as was noted by the Department of Labor in testimony in the legislative hearing in March, we did a 27% increase, the largest increase any jurisdiction had ever done basically in one day on a minimum wage. And what happened? If you compared the total non-farm employment, which is the standard reference when you talk about how many jobs were created during one administration or lost during another one, that's the number we're talking about. It excludes fishers, crew share fisher persons, military, and self-employed. So the total non-farm employment up there, 2003 was 1.5% higher than the year before after the increase, and the average monthly wage 1.7% higher. The total private sector employment was kind of the numbers were flipped. The total employment, average monthly employment, how you measure it, went up 1.7, wages 1.5. But then look at the four industries identified by the Department of Labor, Alaska Department of Labor, as where the most low-wage, minimum wage, near minimum wage workers are concentrated. Seafood processing, retail trade, accommodation, and food services and drinking places. In all of those, retail trade dragged a little, but in those there were large increases, at least, and in two cases much larger than the overall employment increase, and wages, with the exception of accommodation, hotels, where it was only up about 1%, up substantially, not surprisingly, because the minimum wage was increased. So that's a pretty good indication. And this, again, this time we're doing a 26% increase, and we're spreading it out over 2 years. Now, there's always other factors involved, but we have very, we believe, clear and convincing evidence that in food service and drinking places, for example, you would have thought the world was going to end if the employers were not allowed to charge, to utilize a so-called tip credit, where the employer of waiters and waitresses pays as little under federal law as $2 an hour to those employees. Now, who's affected as minimum wage or low-wage workers? You don't look at who's making the minimum wage. That is really a relatively low number. Department of Labor figures about 2,500 people actually make the minimum wage. Well, that's a testament to the fact that our current minimum wage is obsolete. It has ceased to function to provide even a sub-basement floor to the wage system. The Department of Labor estimates that on January 1st, 2016, this is unpublished data, but they come up with a number of 28,000 people at that. 28,000 workers will be making less than $9.75 the day that it goes in the second increase to $9.75. And then you always look at indirect because as wage schedules and salary schedules are bumped up, there's a spillover effect. The Congressional Budget Office used a number that went, I think, $1.40 over 10-10 when they examined the federal proposal. But 20,000 workers who would be making $9.75 to $10.75 would likely see a raise and are considered the indirectly affected. That's 48,000 Alaskans, potentially 48,000 hardworking in some of our toughest occupation and industries, Alaskan families that would benefit from this. And they're not teenagers. They're not all part-timers. 78% of those total, 48,000, are 20 years of age and over. 57% are women. 25% are raising kids on those low wages. This graph is kind of busy, but it shows it's an analysis of the last 5 months of 2013 as opposed to the first 5 months of 2014 wage growth. And 13 states, mostly because they had CPI adjustment, New Jersey because there was an overwhelmingly passed referendum there last election day, November. All of them except Jersey show job growth, in most cases job growth higher than the national average. Now, some folks will say, well, you know, they're going to pass on the costs to the customers. We're all going to pay more. It's going to hurt poor people more than anybody else. But a couple of things to that. We would submit we're already, the cost is already passed on to us for low-wage employment. Not to pick on Walmart, but they are the largest employer in the country, about 1.1 million employees. 6.2 billion, their employees receive 6.2 billion in public assistance. That's $6,000 per worker. If you $6,000 a year per worker. If you assume half of their 1.1 million employees have family wage jobs and don't get any public assistance, that averages $12,000 for those that do. In the fast food industry with a lot of low-wage workers, almost $7 billion, $6.85 billion between Medicaid, earned income tax credit, and food stamps. 52% of the families of frontline fast food workers are enrolled in one or more public assistance programs versus 25% of the workforce as a whole. Now, I collected a lot of signatures. It's very interesting, a great way to see how Alaskans feel about this issue and about the economy and the plight of low-wage workers. And just give a real quick example as to, you know, the small business reaction. I was collecting signatures in downtown Sitka, and in the same afternoon, within the space of about 2 hours, at first, I had one gallery owner come up. She had a gallery in Sitka, and she had a seasonal one over in Skagway for the tourist trade. And she said, "Yeah, I'll sign that. You know, I have small businesses, but I start my people at $15. I don't see how anybody could expect somebody to live in Sitka on even $10 an hour." And within about an hour, I had another gallery owner. I think she paid $10 or $12, but basically said the same thing. Signed the petition enthusiastically. Within another hour, I had a young woman come up and said, "Oh, let me sign that. I'm stuck at $7.75, and I can't make it at all." I said, where do you work?" She worked in a third gallery, right in the same block. So here's two high road employers paying what they think their employees need to live on, but they're suffering potentially and probably a competitive disadvantage with another gallery owner, same block, same industry, same sector, who's only paying as little as the law allows, $7.75 an hour. This one I'll just run through real briefly. You hear a lot of conservative economists when I debate them talk about, "Oh, this is the wrong program. You should do the earned income tax credit." That's a great program, but it's a spending program, costs $56 billion a year. If you take the average benefit to families with children of the EITC, it's less than $3,000 a year. If you figured that out on a 40-hour week full-time basis, it would only equate to $1.40 an hour. So there's no way you could, without spending billions, multiple billions of dollars, you could equal the economic impact of a minimum wage increase by increasing the earned income tax credit. Also, it does very little for childless adults. The maximum benefit there is $487 a year. What would it mean? Let's put it in real terms. And these are hardworking people working a lot of hours. The majority of them are working more than 35 hours a week of the 48,000 that I said were affected. 49 hours per week. Somebody who's currently working 61 hours, a single wage earner, has to work that many hours, single wage earner with two kids, just to reach the federal poverty level. This would go down to 49 hours. They'd still be working their butts off, but maybe they have a little more time to spend with their family, help their kids with their homework. Alaskans have always supported supported a higher minimum wage. We've always opposed the so-called tip credit. We believe, based on polls and based on our conversations with thousands of Alaskans, that given the opportunity to vote on this, which they now have, despite legislative chicanery in the last session, Alaskans will vote on this. And we believe, given the experience of 2002, 2003, when presented with an opportunity to have increased employment and higher wages, more, better quality of jobs, they're going to say yes resoundingly. Thank you very much.
Ed, thank you. I'm going to invite you up here after to be part of the question and answers, and invite Denny DeWitt and Peggy Ann. Who's going to speak for the? Okay, thank you very much. And do you have a slideshow?
No, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
No entertainment other than me. So thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, my opportunity to come here and testify is important, and thank you very much for allowing us the time. My name is Peggy Ann McConaughey. My husband, John, and I own two small businesses here in Juneau, a real estate brokerage and a bike shop that does sales, rentals, and tours. We are members of the National Federation of Independent Business Alaska. We oppose Proposition 3. We know that this proposition is not in the best interest of the Alaskans it is intended to affect. Should Proposition 3 pass, it would have two immediate effects, but not the one the supporters would have you believe. First, teenage unemployment will increase over time, reducing their chances of getting valuable work experience. Prop 3 supporters point to Washington State as an example Alaska should follow. In 2013, both states had similar unemployment rates, 6.5% in Alaska and 7% in Washington. But for the minimum wage, but for young adults aged 16 to 19, the situation was much different. In Alaska, where Washington's, where the minimum wage is $7.75 an hour, teen unemployment was 17.5%. In Washington State, where the minimum wage was $9.32 an hour and rises every year because of indexing to inflation, the teen unemployment rate was an astounding 30.6%. In Oregon, the minimum wage is $9.10, and the teen unemployment rate is 27.4%. A loss of opportunity at the bottom rungs of the career ladder is not is concerning not just because teens miss out on spending cash, but also teens who miss out on an early career experience are at a distinct disadvantage. For instance, research has found that seniors in high school with a part-time job are earning higher wages 6 to 9 years after graduation than their counterparts who didn't work. Lengthy spells of unemployment have also been shown to increase the risk of future unemployment for young people. In this regard, the last thing Alaska should do is trying to emulate the youth unemployment rates in Oregon and Washington State. Second, the ability of low-skilled workers to earn income, especially those assisting seniors with errands and chores around the house, will be drastically cut, harming two groups of people at once. Elderly Alaskans on fixed incomes will be forced to reduce the amount of goods and services they can afford. This will be particularly devastating to those who are hiring casual helpers to assist with household chores they are no longer able to do for themselves. Data show that families earning at least three times the poverty level are more likely to benefit than those earning below it, making a minimum wage increase an unproductive anti-poverty initiative. These results are not just a matter of speculation, but economic patterns that have followed every increase in the minimum wage. It is vital voters know the truth about the minimum wage. 99% of all hourly wage workers in Alaska, all but 2,000 people, already earn above the minimum wage. This is from 2012, which is the latest stat that was available. More than 50% of minimum wage workers are under age 24, so raising the rate removes the first rung of the economic ladder of life for young adults, as business owners are forced to cut back on hiring in order to meet the cost increase. After the last federal increase in the minimum wage, 500,000 teenage jobs disappeared following 6 months, and that was in a period of economic recovery when more jobs should have been available. The average annual family income of those earning the minimum wage nationally in 2009 was over $48,000. Significantly more will get a raise from increased minimum wage, our families earning three times the poverty level. And 83% of minimum wage earners are teenagers living with working parents, adults living alone, or dual-income couples. What happens when minimum wages rise too high? Remember filling station attendants? How about baggers in grocery stores? Or, for older people, ushers in movie theaters? All have been eliminated. Technology may do the same for today's minimum wage jobs. Placing orders through touchscreens and the self-checkout is growing in Alaska. Losing these jobs means losing the bottom rung on the career ladder and fewer opportunities for the people who used to fill these jobs. Of course, other factors besides the minimum wage can determine teen employment rates, but a careful look at the data shows that a higher minimum wage has played a role. Using data from 2005 through 2011, economists from Miami and Trinity University estimated that over 4,300 teens had jobs in Washington State due to the higher minimum wage. One article in Seattle Weekly provided a striking example of how these jobs are eliminated. Restaurants in Seattle, the state's largest city, have generally stopped hiring bus people, opting to have servers bus their own tables instead, and are scheduling fewer servers per shift due to the higher cost. These consequences are broadly consistent with what we see in the economic research on minimum wage increases. Since the early 1990s, roughly 85% of the most credible academic studies on the subject show that a higher minimum wage reduces employment for the least skilled and least experienced employees. That doesn't mean there aren't outliers, but they're in a distinct minority. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office understood this, and that's why it estimated a 500,000 lost jobs nationwide from a proposed $10.10 federal minimum wage hike. An unfortunate reality we must recognize is that small businesses, those most affected by the minimum wage, cannot support employees that are not bringing to the business a value equal to their compensation. The businesses are also providing unemployment insurance, workers' compensation insurance, and Social Security employer tax at a minimum in addition to the basic wage. And over half of these employers are providing additional benefits, such as health insurance. As these total employee costs increase, businesses must look to mechanization and computerization in order to stay in business and not end unemployment for its employees at any compensation level. Given the reality of whom the proposed increase in the minimum wage will hurt, the young starting their lives and the seniors in the sunset of their lives, we can only hope and recommend that Alaskans vote no on this perhaps well-meaning proposal. It is not the intention we will be voting on. It is the actual effect on the young and the old. Economist William J. Dennis, who has been studying small business and the minimum wage for nearly 40 years, asks, quote, "Employers want experienced workers. How do you get experience when you price people out of the market in the first place?" Unquote. Thank you for the opportunity to share our opposition to you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to invite you, Peggy Ann, and Ed to sit up here in case questions come up where proponents and opponents, and Denny, you're very welcome to join as well. Denny DeWitt is with the group signed up as opposing with the National Federation for Independent Business. Now what we'd like to do is, first off, let me announce that we have online Joe Dunham with the Wage and Hour Group at the Department of Labor, Dan Robinson and Anna Latham. And Joe, Dan, and Anna, thank you for joining us for the third hearing here today. We have one person online who's signed up to testify, but let me just ask first, is there anyone here in the room who would like to testify on this measure? Mr. O'Shea, would you come forward, please?
Good afternoon, Lieutenant Governor Treadwell. I have a written statement, and I'm going to read it because I understand I have 3 minutes, and I want to make sure I cover everything. I'm Vince O'Shea, Vice President of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association. I live here in Juneau. Thank you for the opportunity to offer testimony in opposition to ballot measure 3. PSPA is a nonprofit seafood industry trade association founded in 1914. Our 9 corporate members collectively participate in all Alaska fisheries, purchasing and processing nearly 70% of all the seafood landed in Alaska. We have hundreds of millions of dollars invested in plants and equipment in the Alaskan communities where we operate. We provide markets to thousands of Alaskan fishermen and many more thousands of direct and indirect jobs to plant workers and service providers. We certainly respect the view that people should have the opportunity to earn a decent wage and support themselves. But raising the minimum wage is a poor way to accomplish this and will actually cause harm to both the people it's intended to help as well as others. While raising the minimum wage initially appeals to the public, that support may fade as people are given the opportunity to understand the full range of the impacts. A one-size-fits-all approach to increase wages fails to realistically account for where the increased cost will come from and fails to properly recognize the different economic characteristics of business sectors. There appears to be an assumption that all businesses in all industries currently have the financial resources to pay their workers more or can generate additional revenue to make those payments. That assumption is flawed. Raising the minimum wage especially hurts the employees of businesses who cannot pass on increased labor costs to their customers. 70% of Alaska seafood is sold into the global market, where we are price takers. Alaska accounts for only a small fraction of the global seafood supply. If our prices go up, our customers have many other choices. In the case of Alaskan pollock, our state's largest fishery by volume, those choices include pollock caught and processed by factory trawlers, whose workers are not impacted by the minimum wage. The remaining 30% of Alaska seafood production goes into the U.S. market, where demand for seafood continues to lag that of other protein. Raising prices will not help us sell more fish in those markets. In our case, we'll have to find ways to reduce costs. These will include reducing retirement, health care, and other benefits to new and existing workers, eliminating jobs through automation, and sending more product overseas for finished processing. It will put downward pressure on the prices we pay for raw product and support services. Ironically, while the majority of minimum wage earners in our plants are non-Alaskans, the majority of permit holders and crews delivering to our plants are Alaskans. At the end of the day, buying and processing seafood for more than we can sell it for is not sustainable. By necessity, many of our plants are in remote locations. The significant costs we incur in transporting, housing, feeding, and providing housekeeping services to our workers are not taken into account by an across-the-board increase in the minimum wage. For many of our employees, these services, along with the overtime opportunities we offer, mean they take home a substantially greater paycheck compared to minimum wage earners in Anchorage or in Juneau. The Alaska Chamber and other groups have spoken or will speak in opposition, providing information on how Ballot Initiative 3 fails to help those in poverty while reducing opportunities for workers of all ages to enter the workforce. We'd like to add our voices to their positions, especially with regard to the elements linking Alaska's minimum wage to advances in the federal minimum wage, as well as an annual COLA adjustment in perpetuity, regardless of the overall or sector business climate. Currently, there is no law or regulation prohibiting employers from paying more than the minimum wage, and many businesses do just that. But it's an individual decision that takes into account the economic realities of the business and the markets in which they are operating. We strongly believe that's the way things should operate. Hopefully, after voters realize that raising the minimum wage will put pressure on the cost of goods and services, reduce jobs, restrict opportunities for people to enter the workforce, and harm businesses, they will agree as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea. Let me ask you to stay in the box if you can for a moment and see, first off, do you have any questions for the Department of Labor experts online? Or
I do not.
And do our proponents or opponents have any questions for Vince?
Well, just one, Captain. Now, your Pollock, your members that are Pollock processors, they actually get a set allocation of a public good, the Pollock fishery. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, and you don't think it's appropriate for the public to have some input about what they pay, what minimal level of pay they pay to the employees in that industry, which they have a near monopoly on?
No, I don't, because the public doesn't have an input on what we pay for salmon, which is also a public resource that has a restricted harvest access to by Alaskans. And there's other examples in the seafood business where we're free to use market forces to set the price of what we pay for the products we're buying.
Yes, one more question, Lieutenant
Governor.
I'm a little out of date since I was out there when I was labor commissioner, but I think there's roughly peak season around 2,000 workers in the three onshore plants at Dutch Harbor. Could you give me a guess of how many of those people get retirement and medical?
I can't give you that.
Probably pretty low, isn't it?
No, I don't think it is. One of the things that at least one of our major members out there is making contributions to retirement plans as well as providing medical plans, because that's one of the things that they're anticipating having to cut if this minimum wage goes through.
For the processors online who make $7.75 an hour?
Yes.
Yeah. And it's my understanding that those workers make $7.75 whether they're in their first year or their fourth year right now. Is that correct?
I don't have the details on the specific companies or what those employment agreements are.
And I think you were probably still in the Coast Guard 2002, but, you know, I did quote that number and showed that number. We had a lot of the same claims of doom and gloom and world market and why the industry shouldn't be precluded from engaging in a race to the bottom in terms of wages. And as you saw from the slide, employment was up significantly, and those were a lot more challenging times in terms of price, I think you'd agree, than it is today.
Right, and I thought about that, Commissioner, as well. And I noticed that, for example, salmon over those years that you looked at, we had almost probably 20-25% increase in the volume of salmon from 202 to 204, and that's a labor-intensive species, as you know. And I also looked at some data that, you know, that ASME has in their 2014 report, that's actually showing a, you know, sort of a steady rise in employment. But what's also happening there is we've benefited by both, in some fisheries, higher volumes of fish, as well as changes in the world market. So the idea to say that, you know, I don't think I could agree with the notion that we increase wages and therefore created more jobs. There were other factors that drove into the increase in numbers. And there's no guarantee that how much fish we're going to get back in any given year, and there's no guarantee what's going to happen in Chile or Ecuador or the other producers that we compete against on the global market.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jenny, do you have any questions?
No, great testimony. Thank you.
Let me ask a question generally. You made the statement that if the minimum wage is raised, it's likely that Alaskans export more fish in the round for finished processing in Asia. Is labor cost the primary reason now that we send so many salmon raw to Asia to be processed? And it's not. I believe it's not just salmon. I believe it may be other fish frozen in blocks. And what do you think could be done to help reduce the amount that we export so we can get more value-added processing here in the state?
Well, this is 214, this year's ASME annual report. And I don't know if you can see it from here, but and I'll pass it up if you want. But they're already reporting that we're exporting about $1.3 billion of Alaska seafood to China, South Korea, and Asia. And much of that product is being reworked in those countries and then sent elsewhere. There's a fraction of that is, you know, may reside in the country because it's going to be marketed in the country, but I think it's safe to say that the vast majority of this is reflects the wage differentials to process that material. So what could be done to keep more of this work done in the United States and keep it in Alaska? What we're trying to do is put automation in to reduce the labor costs, to be blunt and frank with you. But the other part is developing markets to take this product as well. So I'm not sure if I fully answered your question, but that product is already going overseas for reprocessing to Asian countries, and if our costs go up, that would put pressure to send more of that product over there.
Okay. Has there been pressure on you because of a change in immigration rules where you're not allowed to bring in guest workers now in your industry, and does this provide additional pressure?
If you're talking about the J-1 visa program,
right,
which allows students to come in,
right,
I would estimate for our members that might be, that's a component of our labor force, and it has affected us. But, you know, every year we have different challenges thrown at us, and each year we manage to get through a season. We manage to get the fish put up and put place. So I think where it makes a difference, Lieutenant Governor, is in deciding what type of processing we're going to do. And if we have sufficient labor, then we're going to go to the value-add, higher-value products. But if we got to do sheer volume with minimum amount of workers, we're going to do on salmon, we're going to do head and gut, glaze, freeze them, pack them, and send them someplace else where we have where we can get access to reasonable labor costs to process the fish. So that's how that sort of the cushion goes.
Okay. In your testimony, you mentioned that the cost of living increase or the COLA provisions of this law don't recognize the sector where it's applied. In other words, the cost of living may be going up generally in the state, but in your industry, you may find competitive pressure to bring it down. Have you sought, or is there any way that you could kind of see that issue taken care of with even our existing wage and hour laws at this point?
Well, I think you make a really good point, and I think that's the overall point of my testimony and our position. This is a complex issue, and it affects a number of different industries and businesses in different ways. And I think it needs to be dealt with. The goal of helping people in poverty, improving workers' status, needs to be done in a deliberate way through legislation so that the different peculiarities of the different workforces can be adjusted for and taken into account. So my long-winded thing, I mean, the cost of living thing scares the heck out of us. You know, so while our cost of living goes up, that doesn't mean that the people we're selling fish to overseas are going to have the means or the interest in buying our fish at a higher price. Some of the salmon farmers, for example, and you might recall this, had tremendous problems with disease that really knocked them back in terms of their production and their capability. That's helped our salmon markets considerably. But if they get that straightened out, they have a low cost structure down there, say down in Chile. They have low labor costs down there. And then for us to be locked into constant increase in prices based on the cost of a living in Alaska is very, very daunting and scary to me.
And I guess the last question, and this question also is, and I'll be with you just a second, Ed, for the folks at the Department of Labor, we've heard a bunch of numbers fly around today, but one of them was that only 2,000 people are paid on the minimum wage at the present time. Is that the right number? And maybe let me just ask that question of Joe, Dan, and Anna. How many people are paid by minimum wage today?
This is Dan Robinson at Department of Labor. We estimate that fewer than 1%, so fewer than 3,000 jobs in Alaska, are paid minimum wage.
Okay, and do you agree with the general principle that Ed laid out in his slideshow that the minimum wage floor affects the wages of other workers in the state.
We haven't studied that, but that economic concept makes sense, that there would be some trickle-up effect. The specifics would be hard to quantify.
And Ed used the number of 20 and 28,000, or about 48,000.
28 and 20. Yeah,
28 and 20, yeah.
Yeah, that would be somebody else's. I think that's Economic Policy Institute, so we couldn't really vouch for that.
But you provided the 28,000 direct, Dan.
The 28,000, I'm thinking we missed the first part of the call. That would be our estimate of the number of jobs that pay 975 or less.
Okay, and just in your industry, how, you know, just do you have a guess, and maybe I missed it in your testimony, of the aggregate number of people who would be affected by this change in law?
First of all, you didn't miss it, my testimony. I didn't put it
right
in there. But now I do have a question about for the Department of Labor. On that 1,000 worker number, I mean, our PSPA members we're probably 15,000 to 18,000 non-skilled workers in our plants. There's a McDowell report that they did for ASME. In 2013, they said 27,000 was the seafood worker number for Alaska. So for the Department of Labor, 1,000 people at the minimum wage, I mean, I work for the processors. It sure seems to me that we have a lot more workers than that at the minimum wage than 1,000. Is there any way to reconcile? These are seasonal jobs. Would that affect your count of 1,000?
It would. It would absolutely. These aren't people. They're annualized jobs. So a job that's 3 months would equate to one quarter of a job annualized. So that's one of the reasons. And then we also acknowledge a fair amount of uncertainty at that low end especially. Alaska employers aren't required to report the number of hours they work to the same degree they are some of the other data points. So it's possible that number's a little larger. It's an estimate.
That helps rectify something for me. Let's go ahead and then we'll...
Certainly. So if you want to talk, I came in here without polling all my companies and such, but I came in here comfortable saying we're between 15 and 18,000 employees that potentially are going to be affected by this. And the other thing you need to keep in mind is that when that minimum wage moves even a dollar, it also moves, you know, the overtime rate. So the nature of our business, it's like the apple guys and it's like the corn guys. When the stuff is ready to be harvested, we're going 7 days a week. Plants are running 24 hours a day, and people are clocking 80 and 90 hours a week. That's the nature of the business. But once they hit over 40, they hit time and a half, and that, you know, that dollar is going to go into that as well. So we're talking an immediate impact of millions of dollars per company if and when this goes into effect.
Thank you.
A couple of things. The 2,000 number that Ms. McConaughey quoted was actually from the federal government. They did state-by-state workers making less than the federal minimum wage, and that may be the most meaningless statistic ever produced by BLS, since especially in a state like us where we have a minimum wage higher than the federal. So when you talk about those 2,000, you're talking about youth who are exempt from the minimum wage, because one thing I failed to mention, Alaska law, we do nothing to change a longstanding provision in Alaskan law when it gets to teen employment that exempts workers under the age of 18, and this wouldn't apply to your industry because of the hazard and stuff, but workers under 18 who work 30 hours or less are not even covered by the Alaska law. So that moots a lot of the teen impact or alleged teen impact. With regard to, I was also surprised, like Captain O'Shea, when the department, and I'll stand by the Department of Labor's numbers. I mean, I'll take their numbers over an outside group anytime. When they said 2,500 annualized jobs, because I know there's roughly 2,000 probably making $7.75 an hour in Dutch Harbor alone.
Right.
But you mentioned Chile, but
You're standing by it, but you're questioning it.
No, I didn't question it. Oh, I said I had some doubt, but when Dan Robinson, when Research and Analysis says 2,500, then you know I'll take that number. But as I said earlier, that just proves that the minimum wage in this state has ceased to perform its function. It has ceased to provide a meaningful floor under the wage system. And the number of workers that actually make the minimum wage is not the issue. The number of workers who make that 20,000, who make less than what we propose to raise it to, is the families and workers that will be affected. And just one more question for Captain O'Shea. They still do a lot of the salmon farming in B.C., don't they?
They do.
And you're aware of the minimum wage in Canada?
I'm not.
It's about 12 and a half bucks an hour. Thank you.
Denny. Thank you, Mr. Lieutenant Governor. Denny DeWitt, I'm the state administrator for the National Federation of Independent Business. On the team hiring issue, this is really one that is very, very interesting, and it shows a tremendous lack of understanding. The issue is, with reference to team employment, is not whether or not you pay the federal minimum wage or the state minimum wage. The real issue is whether or not the businesses have the cash to pay those people at all. The result of these kinds of increases is that, well, for example, the minimum wage, once you figure out the cost of the minimum wage for an annual employee plus the Social Security employer's cost, the Medicare cost, et cetera, it's about a $4,500 hidden tax, and it's taking that money out of the resources of the employer that limits the employer's ability to hire anybody, whether you're paying them $2 an hour or $15 an hour. So the issue is not what the rate is. It's whether or not, or is how the aggregate of these kinds of activities impact the amount an employer has available to pay their employees and the number of positions that they can pay. That's why we see an elimination of a lot of entry-level and unskilled jobs changing to mechanization and computerization. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Vince? Vince, thank you very much for joining us. And I'll say this because this is the third hearing on this issue. We had on two other hearings. One was held in Nome and or Kotzebue, and the other was held in Barrow. The issue on the CPI, many people testified that they had hoped that the CPI would be figured more on a regional basis around the state because the cost of living is higher in different places. And this is the first time we've heard the presentation, the argument that when you're competing in a global market, the local CPI doesn't necessarily help you vis-a-vis one sector of industry versus the other. So thank you for providing that. And I will say, if you'd like your written testimony to be posted as the testimony of the others, please give it to us, and we'll try to get it on the website. What's interesting about this hearing compared to the three-hour hearing that we held on marijuana earlier this afternoon is there's very little question about how the law would work, how it would be implemented. Lots of question about how it would affect the economy. On the other issue, there's lots of question about how the law might work and as well as how it affects society. So thank you very much for enlightening us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Is there anyone else here in the room who would like to testify? We have one person online, Kevin Turnington, who's online, is interested in testifying on this issue. Kevin, if you're still online, the floor is yours.
All right, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you loud and clear.
Great. Well, my name's Kevin Turkington, and I own and operate a non-medical in-home care company here in Anchorage. For over 12 years, we've helped senior and vulnerable adults remain safely independent in their own homes for as long as possible. Aging in place has proven time and again to be one of the most cost-effective ways to deliver quality care. It also honors the wishes that the majority of Alaskans have about staying in their own homes versus assisted living homes or nursing homes. Raising the minimum wage often has a negative effect on those it is intended to help. There is overwhelming reporting that makes it clear raising the minimum wage doesn't lift people out of poverty, and it dilutes performance-based raises meant to encourage entry-level workers to move up from those positions. Entry-level positions weren't intended as a career choice. Separate from what I believe are the obvious reasons why raising the minimum wage in the manner which is being discussed, including increasing the gap from the federal minimum wage and including yearly inflation increases. My concern is what it will do to the cost of care for those elderly and vulnerable adults who depend on the care they need staying within reach. Living care based on current labor laws and minimum wage creates a cost for a senior to receive in-home care equal to about half what it would cost them to be in a nursing facility and some assisted living homes. Raising the minimum wage would force the cost of care up approximately 34% by 2017. Therefore, strapping seniors who don't qualify for public assistance with even higher costs. That represents about 65% of the senior population in Alaska, according to the most recent census. Add to that the caregiving companion exemption going away January 1st of 2015, as per the wage and hour fact sheet number 25. Based on labor laws in Alaska, an individual that works more than 8 hours a day and more than 40 hours a week, regardless of what capacity, must be paid overtime. For a living care, that's 8 hours of regular time and 15 hours of overtime for one 24-hour shift. Raising the minimum wage in this scenario means the cost of in-home care must increase accordingly to pay for the increased labor burdens and expenses, about 36% related to providing this care as an employer agency. In other words, the cost of care would rise to what is currently being charged clients. The bottom line, continually raising the cost of providing products and services for seniors causes them to run out of money much sooner. This totally defeats the value and cost savings of aging in place and forces more and more of them onto the Medicaid rolls. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Let me just ask, please stay on the line here. Joe or Dan with the Department of Labor, or Anna, is it true that can you explain the change that Kevin talked about in terms of home care, where soon the overtime issues will change?
Let's see. This is Joe Dunham. I'm not real sure of the question. The overtime law would stay the same. Generally, I can't even say if these payments to the assisted living home and personal care attendant agencies, whether or not they're getting paid through Medicaid or not, but generally they are, and the Medicaid is well aware of the overtime requirements. The question is still kind of vague.
Yeah, may I say something to that real quick?
Sure, yeah. Kevin, why don't you restate what you said?
Yeah. First of all, I'm not referring to Medicaid agencies at all. I'm referring to those who are paying out of pocket or using long-term care insurance. Medicaid does pay whatever it is they're paying and reimbursing. I couldn't tell you that because I'm not a Medicaid provider. But I do know that based on one of the most recent censuses, at least 60% of all seniors and vulnerable adults in Alaska 60 and over don't qualify for Medicaid benefits, so which is a greater amount of people than those who actually receive it. And so the cost of that care is about paying individuals to provide care to seniors and vulnerable adults in their own homes. And currently, we do pay based on that minimum wage. Now, granted, all our staff make considerably more as a base hire on rate, but they also agree to a separate wage for providing 24-hour type living care for those clients who require 24-hour oversight, which does allow them to have a cheaper cost at staying in their own home and aging in place versus having to be shifted into a nursing home and or assisted living home. The companion care exemption that I'm referring to is a federal exemption that's being removed according to that fact sheet 25. It was a pretty large federal issue here as of late, which at least out of state, those employers were able to exempt, not have to pay their workers overtime for those live-in type situations and those who are doing companion care and non-medical assistance for the elderly and vulnerable adults. That has not really been an issue in Alaska per se, based on us providers who follow the letter of the law, mind you, but many companies in Alaska still circumvent that by not paying for sleep time and things like that, so that if there was a real issue, my guess is if they were called to task, they would have some hefty fines about paying overtime and so on for lost hours and what have you. But anyway, the issue is really has nothing to do with Medicaid, other than the fact that if we continue rising these costs, we're going to run people out of money pretty darn quick. They're going to be forced out of their homes into assisted living homes where we don't have enough beds as it is, and onto the Medicaid rolls, which is already hugely a problem in Alaska.
Okay, so I guess what I was trying to figure out from my own standpoint, our office was asked, you know, it's required by law to prepare a cost estimate, and if a change in the minimum wage, we said, as I stated earlier in this hearing, that we don't see a direct cost to the state in terms of the minimum wage going up, but there may be an indirect cost to the state where we reimburse caregivers, either home caregivers or senior living home caregivers due to Medicaid. And so I guess the question there that I can't turn around and ask somebody from the Department of Health right now, but we should look at that, April, and just see if there's a modification that we missed. And then the second question that was just brought up by Mr. Turnington's testimony is this minimum wage change happening at the same time a federal exemption is changing on people who kind of stay in your home and sleep in your home, a senior's home, and avoiding care. And I don't see I guess what you're saying is that if there had been a federal exemption, it's going away, and it's going away at the same time the minimum wage would go up, and so therefore it's increasing the cost. Two things are working to increase the cost of senior home care at the same time. And
correct.
Okay. I get that point, and there's some both the proponents and the opponents here would like to comment on that. Let me turn first.
Well, if your office or any agency is going to take it upon itself to go into the weeds on Medicaid, I think you really need to look at the Department of Labor and ask them what decile of home care workers and their stats are even affected by this. And Mr. Turkington, I was going to ask him the question, but apparently he pays even his starting people, he says, significantly more than minimum wage, so they wouldn't even be impacted. We got a very elaborate red herring here. We did research to see what occupations would be impacted, you know, be preparing for our campaign, debate, whatever. And home health care workers did not, or in very few cases, checking the Department of Labor stats, checking openings advertised, were generally up in the 12 to 15 minimum. So they're even beyond the dollar over what we propose to raise it to. So before we let build this whole structure, and overtime is overtime. I mean, that's been the law since 1938, the same as the minimum wage. The fact that a worker works a lot of hours does not mean that they should make a lower minimum wage. In fact, the Supreme Court has shot down attempts to come up with so-called flexible work hour plans, the Alaska Supreme Court, to its credit, years ago, and maintains that discipline.
So you're calling what Mr. Turnington said is a red herring.
Yes, I believe it is.
I should add something. This is Joe Dunham, wage and hour again. The only exemption from minimum wage as far as the state is concerned is if there is no agency. If the patient at home directly hires the caregiver for them to work in their home, there is an exemption, and there always has been. However, if there's an agency, that exemption is lost. Now, federally, there was an exemption, and that exemption now is lost, which basically brings it in line to what the state has always been. There is no exemption if there's a third-party agency.
This is Kevin Turkington. Just one quick and final note regarding this. I don't dispute that, in essence, raising the minimum wage currently would directly affect my staff, other than that about 50% of all the services we provide, and 25 to 30% of most other agencies provide sleepover and live-in care to senior and vulnerable adults. Most, in fact, all of them, except for those who are trying to circumvent it, are paying that and charging accordingly based on Alaska's minimum wage of $7.75 an hour plus overtime. So immediately that will cause those costs to go up, as I stated, by 34% on the cost side and 37% up on the 36% up on the recipient side. So it's not always, again, I think my argument isn't so much about raising the cost, although it is, it's what it's going to do on the other end, because you can't keep raising the cost without it having to charge more, because there isn't, you know, we don't have any money growing on trees and it's not infinite. And so it's got to come from somewhere or it gets lost. And if we can't charge, it's kind of like the market goes away, or we price ourselves out of the market, there's no longer a market. There goes 50% of that service and the jobs that go with it, as well as the clients who can no longer afford it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lieutenant Governor. To add to the issue relative to how it impacts Medicaid, and that is that seniors who are on fixed incomes, incomes are fixed. And while you can and have legislatively raised the minimum wage historically, there's no recollection in my mind where folks on fixed incomes have had a mandated increase in their incomes, nor businesses that provide those services. So it's a one-side push. And as Mr. Flanagan indicated in his opening testimony, something with which we concur, the minimum wage has a cascading effect in terms of moving other wages up. So the issue seems to me that's on the table is how much quicker does the minimum wage cause our seniors to run out of their funds and therefore become eligible for Medicaid? That's the question I think Mr. Turkington was raising.
Thank you. Ed?
I would just have to point out, Denny, I'm sure you're familiar with Social Security, which has a cost of living increase and many, many government programs and benefit programs and medical programs have built-in cost of living, often built on the same CPI. It's only been labor, people's work at the low end that has been, you know, somehow it's a terrible thing if they are, you know, their minimal earning power is protected against inflation.
Okay. Well, I guess my to close off this part of the discussion, when we looked at a cost estimate of the state, because the state is a direct provider of Medicaid services, and you know, when any of you here become lieutenant governor, you'll find you'll get lots of casework from senior care providers as well as senior care recipients who are concerned about what's being reimbursed and what's not. And I don't think we looked at that in the cost estimate. And it may well be that there is no effect on the cost estimate, but we will check, number one. Number two, in terms of the speculation that raising the minimum wage would drive more people onto Medicaid, I don't think we would have included that in a cost estimate there, and that's an argument for the public to judge. Here you say you don't believe it's going to affect it. Denny and Kevin say they do, and that's up to the public to judge. Mm-hmm. And I guess the basic question about whether or not this is a double whammy at the same time in terms of the federal exemption is was discussed. I don't know. I know it's I don't know enough about the wage and hour laws myself to know where is it that you can, for example, hire a caretaker for your property. It's a, you know, you might have a mini warehouse system where you've got somebody living on site, because if somebody's breaking in at 2 a.m, you want somebody on site, but they're only open at the desk from 9 to 5, you know, as an example. And I don't know how the wage and hour rules work on that when someone's there, you know, a cook at a camp where if the geologists get back in at 2 a.m. and the 24-hour day, you know, when you're cooking and when you're sleeping and getting paid, but you're on call. So, I mean, there's a lot of issues there in terms of minimum wage that have to do with various exemptions. I don't understand. I'm not sure the public understands. And I guess the question that's raised here is how would this affect those kind of pay arrangements.
Well, again, I would submit if you take it upon yourself or the Department of Health and Social Services does to go spelunking around looking for costs, you ought to look at benefits too, like the reduction that was shown by the Division of Public Assistance in 2002 in demand for public assistance services when you increase the minimum wage for low-wage workers. It better be a whole global look at the impact of the minimum wage and not just cherry-picking.
Well, and that's fine. I'm not trying to spelunk on either side of the issue. I mean, we asked each department to give us an impact if there was an impact. So,
and I believe they did.
I might point out that they should have looked at the entire issue back in the early 2000s as opposed to the cherry-picking that they in fact did. So cherry-picking is not a one-sided issue, as you well know.
Give me an example of what cherry-picking was done in 2002.
They looked at the they didn't look at the number of elderly who ultimately were impacted in the fashion that the discussion was.
Nobody has established that that's the case. And as staff to the House Finance Committee at the time, you were certainly empowered to get that on the record, Denny.
Okay.
If it was true, which it isn't.
Okay.
Well, that's a matter of conjecture, and you're welcome to it.
Yeah, well.
All right. Is there anyone else who's interested in testifying on this matter in today's hearing? No one online? Anyone else here? Do any of the folks here have any questions for the Department of Labor folks with us? Well, I'd like to thank you all. And, Ed, I know it's your third hearing. Denny, you've helped arrange the opposition for each hearing. Our next hearing on this issue will be in Ketchikan on Wednesday at 4 o'clock at the Ketchikan Gateway Borough Assembly Chambers. Our roadshow continues. We'll be in Anchorage on the 23rd of September, 12 to 2, at the Dena Center. Thursday, September 25th, at the Curtis Menard Memorial Sports Center in the Matanuska Valley. Monday, September 29th in Bethel, and Wednesday, October 1st in Fairbanks at the Assembly Chambers. And I appreciate this. I understand that this one of the hardest parts of a piece of legislation like this is knowing the effect on the economy. And there's good arguments I've heard on both sides, and I appreciate the way that you guys have conducted this debate. Thank you very much, and we stand adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you.